this for our Persian meetings instead of...
Where do you guys go for that?
Usually the library. Some library.
Yeah, you should.
We reserve rooms.
You can check the times over there in the front. They're pretty open. So, I think it's on the other side.
Actually, it's pretty open, but at the time we are meeting,
no.
Something's going on here. It's possible.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What time do you guys meet?
Oh, no, sorry. That's
like 4:30 to 5 usually.
No, it's... I was wrong. Massimo thinks I'm...
Mas!
Mosh!
Got two. Oh, boy.
Elevators are for wimps.
They are.
It's dangerous to
man them.
Yeah. Didn't know that.
Trevor heading over.
Ta-da-da!
I thought he'd use the city there. Alright, well, I got some pretty intense handouts.
What do we?
Oh, yeah.
Alright.
Oh, yeah, lots of charts.
Let's do it.
It's happening.
Oh, shit, dude. Tired? Yeah, that's a bit better.
Some of those might be like old Armenian saying.
Tired is father. Oh, there is bear. Oh, I don't have cigar anymore.
Right, got some sound correspondence.
Or
yeah.
Sad.
Nice.
Yellow.
It's a yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Armenian's rough because there's so many
Armenian
and stuff. So I got pretty intense handouts.
Cool.
So my idea, I guess I'm de facto leader, but there doesn't
de facto
there
leader.
Doesn't have to be a leader.
You're the official leader.
I guess for the first couple of weeks, I'll just run you guys through like what I know about Indo-European phonology, morphology, whatever. And we can probably go through different language families or like cater this to whatever anyone else wants to do. But I guess. So, like, I sort of have a gist of, like, shit we can talk about, but obviously, like, if you have something more interesting that you want to talk about, you can do that, too. So, opening Locuenda, section one. So I guess everyone knows that Indo-European exists. It's composed of verbs.
Let's start with what Locuenda means.
So, Locuenda, it's like, well, that's a good Indo-European question, actually. So, Locuenda, in Latin, there are these set of verb endings, so like loquacious talk, and then indom and stuff like that. That's called a gerundive.
Oh, so talking.
You put this on the end of it, and it basically means things that have to be talked about, or something like that, or just to make it so like there's this other verb. That's a thing. Indom and that agenda. So agenda just means the shit you have to do.
Oh.
So,
I learned something.
Yeah, so you've already learned other Indo-European languages that are equivalent to that. Anyway, so now you.
Yeah. Cool.
So we're already done.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've already learned more than that.
So I guess there's a chart there. It has pretty much all the major families of Indo-European in order of attestation.
Wow. That's a nice order.
12.
Baltic and Slavic are two different branches here.
One thing I have to note. So Baltic and Slavic are so similar that most people consider them one language family, so you can sort of think of those, you know, those are sort of the same kind of thing. Same is true of Indo-Aryan and Iranian. Those are usually called Indo-Iranian. But they are very much distinct families. They're just very closely related. So, like, Avestan and Sanskrit are very closely related languages, but they're just, they have their own, like, individuality. And to a lesser extent, Italic and Celtic are sort of...
They were a branch, and they split.
Well, it's very clear that Indo-Aryan and Iranian were definitely one family that split. Same thing with Baltic and Slavic. Well, some people debate about that. But Italic and Celtic, it's really just that they're very, very similar. They have a lot of things in common. But it's not 100% sure if they're that closely related. So I guess I have a couple things. So when you're studying historical linguistics, there are usually two methodologies that you use. One of them is called the comparative method, and one of them is called internal reconstruction. Has anyone heard those words before?
Yeah.
First one,
yeah.
A lot.
Okay, so comparative method is pretty straightforward. Actually, you can pretty much look at what the comparative method is on page 3 and stuff. So that's when you take words of a language and take their phonetic form, and you say, okay, well, these are plausibly related. Let's sort of make a plausible origin point for all of these. So that's pretty much what you do at the beginning of historical linguistics. So a lot of times you just take what looks similar, the thing about historical linguistics is that a lot of it is based on very wide typological knowledge. But you basically make plausibility judgments of, like, okay, where does this word conceivably come from, stuff like that. So the comparative method is sort of a catch-all term for most of what you do in historical linguistics. You're reconstructing forms based on multiple different languages. Internal reconstruction, well, we can actually normalize this. So, you know, you have Latin, you have Sanskrit, whatever, Greek. And the comparative method is when you sort of extract from them commonalities and whatever, and that's called a proto-language. So that there's an official, you know, use of the term. Proto-language is just the result of the comparative method or whatever. And internal reconstruction is something that you can do it on any language individually. So what internal reconstruction is basically when you look at a language's morphology or its phonology or something like that and draw conclusions about previous stages of the language. So like in English, if we didn't know anything about English historical linguistics, we could still do internal reconstruction in English because you have like, you know, you have I sounds that are sort of related to is sounds, so you have like decide, decision, you know, provide, provision, a lot of sounds like this. Same thing with basically any of the doublets you get in the great vowel shift, you have you can sort of see the relationships between these. So even if we didn't have records of English before 2015, we could still look at these patterns and sort of predict that they came from somewhere, that they came from some sort of reconstructed I or something like that. So the asterisk in historical linguistics just means reconstructed.
Yeah.
So that's internal reconstruction. And so once we derive Proto-Indo-European, you can actually do internal reconstruction on that, and you can get to sort of what's usually called a pre-language. So, you know, you have pre-Proto-Indo-European. And what that means is we take what we get from all these other languages, then we sort of look at what we have and say, hey, there are these other alternations that we can sort of figure out. And we'll talk about why that's important, especially when we get to vowels and that.
So, I don't know what you're going to cover, but can you tell us what time period you're talking about when we're talking about Proto-Indo-European?
Well, definitely before all the languages attested here. That's one of that is the question that depends on what kind of hypothesis you have for when and where Proto-Indo-Europeans originated. So most people's idea is that is what's called the Kurgan hypothesis, which you've probably heard of. It's the idea that basically Indo-Europeans come from right north of the Black Sea and sort of Ukraine. There were some kind of nomadic people associated with, usually the domestication of horses or something like that. There are a bunch of stories, and that I think is maybe around 4000 BC. I'm not entirely sure. But other people will have totally different stories that will put them in Anatolia or somewhere in Europe, and they'll be at a totally different time. It all depends on like what kind of theory you have of it. I don't have much on the Kurgan hypothesis in this, or anything on it in this handout, but we can definitely talk about it because it goes, there are a bunch of like crazy things associated with it. So one more thing. Historical linguistics was around way before, it used to just be linguistics. You didn't used to have to say historical linguistics because it was linguistics now. But it evolved way before the IPA came into use. So it's sort of convention never to use the IPA, or at least not usually use it in historical linguistics. So if I write a TH on the board, if we're talking about English, that's the. If we're talking about Sanskrit, it's the. You just have to know. You just have to be ready.
Orthography.
We'll talk about the inventories of all these. But just keep in mind, or for example, you know, when you write a Y, that doesn't mean U, it means ya, or stuff like that. It's just convention, more or less. class, especially in Indo-European studies. So did anyone look at those other two articles I linked to by any weird chance?
The Fortson one?
No, the one that wasn't Fortson. I gave you two internet links to these this random like Web 1.0 site, which actually was very interesting.
Unfortunately, I didn't.
Yeah, well, don't worry about it. But what those were about bad historical linguistics. So there are lots of good ways that you can do bad historical linguistics. And one of the articles was the guy talking about how you can basically, if you're just looking for phonologically similar sounds, you find a bunch of false positives. You find, what he did is he took a bunch of words in Quechua and Chinese and some from French, and he said, hey, these are all plausibly, you know, they have the same origin or whatever. But in historical, and we sort of talked about this last week, the main thing you're looking for, at least in phonology, is sound correspondences. And that's what you have in the chart in section two. So it's not just, okay, these two, this Sanskrit word and this English word look similar. It's that, you know, for every P in Sanskrit, or at least a systematic grouping of P's, there's an F in English, or there's an H in Armenian, or something like that. So it's not just an issue of and of course you can have borrowings too, so English word for Coca-Cola is Coca-Cola, in Chinese it's Coca-Cola. I mean, it doesn't mean they're related, it's because they're borrowed or whatever.
Proto people.
Yeah.
Add Coca-Cola.
Exactly. And of course, actually reconstructing what words you find in Proto-Indo-European is interesting. I mean, obviously they don't have Coke. But I think Trevor said last week, there's
honey.
They had the word for honey, so they were probably around some kind of, you know, bee.
Yeah, I was listening to the same podcast that if you look at the non-human kind of archaeology, well, not archaeology, but historical, whatever, that before 4000 BC, bees were not east of the Ural Mountains, so that they know that the Indo-European should have been west of the
So
the same thing for like the kinds of trees that the names of trees that are European.
So the same, there's actually a big debate on whether Indo-European has the word. Well, it's very clear that most languages share a word for wheel, and with the possible exception of Hittite. So, well, I guess we can talk about this next year. So Indo-European, we're all sure that these languages are related by some kind of proto-language. And it's another thing that's totally sure is that Hittite is the first of these families to branch off from everything else. So Hittites were the first people, and actually Hittite is considerably different from all of these languages. In fact, some people say that, well, I shouldn't say Hittite, it's really the entire Anatolian.
Oh, so that's Indo-Hittite or
something? Yeah, so here you have the rest of Indo-European, here you have Anatolian. It's clear that this broke out before. So some people will say, hey, we shouldn't even call this family they both come from Indo-European. We should call this Indo-European, and this is something like Indo-Hittite or something. This is just totally different. They have all this morphology. It's just that there are a lot of things that Hittite and other Anatolian languages do totally differently. So, for example, every other Indo-European family has three genders. In Hittite, it's very clear that there's no distinction between masculine and feminine. And it seems that the feminine gender came on later on as the addition of some kind of suffix. Different things like, you know, Hittite has different cases. And
I thought the reconstructed Proto-Indo-European gender was inanimate.
That's what I had heard.
That would be...
The ghost. No,
that's not. Yeah, so that's definitely... Well, okay. I guess this sort of goes to what we were talking about before you came in. So there's Proto-Indo-European. So that's what we reconstruct. And we can definitely reconstruct, if you ignore Hittite, you can definitely reconstruct all three genders. But there's another level of analysis called internal reconstruction, where you can look at what you reconstruct and say, hey, this is actually, you know, there are actually variations we can account for by saying there have been recent changes in the language. And so this is
right.
So it's certainly clear that there's an inanimate, animate distinction between that existed at some level back way back when. But by the time all these other Indo-European languages there's a systematic feminine suffix that all of them, or I think all of them use, besides Anatolian. And there are a bunch of other things that Hittite is different on. So a couple, well, I guess we should talk about the phonology or whatever. I guess we'll come back to the words or whatever in a bit. So Indo-European is a really weird language as it's been reconstructed because it has a whole lot of consonants, and at least pre-Indo-European might have only had one vowel. We'll talk about that in a second. But it's really weird. Well, it's not too crazy, so like Georgian, I think some dialects of Georgian only have like two figurative vowels or something like that. And a similar argument has been made of pre-Indo-European. But in terms of the consonant inventory, it's relatively clear. So you have labials, you have coronals, and then you have three series of alveoli. Which are not necessarily palatal stops. They're just probably palatalized velars. Again, no one's entirely sure how they were connected. You have what are called plain velars and then labial velars. So all of that's just on the chart. I actually have a friend at Georgia who has this idea that there aren't really labial velars and they're really uvulars. It's an interesting story, but.
So, no affricates, though?
Yeah, so no affricates. So just in the stops, right, you have voiceless, voiced, and what are sometimes called murmured consonants, or voiced affricates, or So, of course, for those of you who are familiar with Sanskrit, know that Sanskrit has all of these, and then voiceless aspirates as well, but those are nearly certainly not Indo-European. And we can get in that, it has to do with laryngeals and different things. Is that a question?
No.
So the phonological system, again, you always have to put stars. I'm going to forget to put stars or whatever, asterisks, but you're always supposed to. So it's pretty much. So I do put, this is an interesting note, B is in parentheses here.
It's rare.
Yeah. B, so all the other sounds you can reconstruct a lot of forms for, but there are only maybe one or two, or maybe three Indo-European words that have a B in them. So that's, it's interesting, well it's interesting just in itself, but it also, people have made sort of typological argument.
Yeah, they have the words for mom or dad or those kind of infant words.
So the word here, bell, is strength on the handout. And there are a couple other ones, but they're just really rare. And there's this theory in Indo-European linguistics called glottalic theory. And it's sort of they make a typological argument for the fact that these voiced stops aren't actually voiced, they're really ejectives. And the reason that, and that's a little weird.
Oh, yeah, because I know ejective P is really weird.
Exactly, so I guess all of us are somewhat familiar with Arabic. Arabic has a very notable consonant, whatever.
It has P,
no,
it has B. It has B, no P.
Yeah, so it has P, D, K, and T. It is missing P and it's missing G. So across all the world's languages, if you're going to miss one of these six stops, it's either going to be P or G. There's no other ones you're going to miss. If you miss two of them, they're going to be P and G. The same, you're not going to miss B. So it's a little weird that we or at least you're not going to have a highly underrepresented B. So this is a weird thing. But if you're talking about ejectives, so like ba, da, and da. If you're going to miss one of them, you're going to miss this one.
Yeah. If you're going to miss ejectives, you're going to miss G.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Or implosives.
Yeah, implosives, yeah. So it's been argued that the reason that B is so rare is that it was really an ejective. In fact, all of these were actually ejectives. and ejectives often change into voice stops, you know, as time passes.
Sorry, I don't know what an ejective is.
It's like with, you know, globalized airflow. So that's why it's called a glottalic theory, because it's based on the idea that there are two ways. So that, and of course, it's a very controversial theory, because literally none of the reflexes of the sound are going to be ejectives. All Indo-European languages have voice stops.
Just a question about the changing from ejectives to voice stops. Is there some reason for that? Like, is there a, like, I don't know, physiological
acoustic reason? Acoustics is not a thing I would know about.
Yeah.
I know that, I mean, part of the reason of glottalic theory is that apparently that's a plausible argument, but I can't vouch for it. So,
okay. I'll have to look into that, because that's interesting, if it's true.
Yeah. So, I mentioned my friend in Georgia has this theory that labiovelars aren't really labiovelars. I might as well go into this because it's interesting. So in English, you have two phonemes, z and sh. And so, you know, traditionally they differ only by what, anteriority or stridency or whatever appears.
Yeah.
They're different by only one feature. But if you actually look at how people pronounce these, so this is slightly rounded.
Yes.
There's a slight roundedness to this. And this is because if you have two similar sounds, you want to maximize the distinction between them, even if it's not a phonological one. So even if it's just a phonetic one. So my friend's argument was that, first off, labiovelars very rarely become, but in some languages these will become things like P, okay? And that's a little weird for labiovelars. So his idea is that really, you have a H, and sort of like sha, you have this roundedness which is not necessarily phonemically distinct, but it just sort of gradually took over to distinguish it from the other vowel sounds. That's fine. I don't know why I was drawing out of this consonant, because I'm right. So fricatives, only one of them, just sa, so far as we know. We'll talk about them in a second. Liquids, R and L, nasals, M and N, allophone, ama, nearly certain, you can't really reconstruct it. And glides, yun, one, and we'll talk about those when we get to consonants too. So the big thing in Indo-European linguistics are these mysterious things called rituals. And if we talk about anything else in this meeting, this is like next priority. We have to talk about ablal and laryngeals and stuff like that, because it's one of the most, I guess Mike was going on about it last week. He was talking about how elegant of a solution they are. But basically, this is, again, what makes the source sort of famous. There's sort of a morphemic, a morphophonemic alternation in a lot of different Indo-European languages, and Saussure solved it by depositing these invisible consonants called laryngeals.
Uh-huh.
So laryngeals work something like this. There are three of them. H1, H2, H3. So this is the network, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they correspond to different vowels. So here's the thing. Saussure posited these, and they do two things in Indo-European. One is that they color vowels near them. They at least color E. So E is the sort of the Indo-European vowel. It's the vowel that Indo-European definitely has. All the other ones, I don't know. So if you have the second laryngeal and an E, this will gradually become this E will gradually be colored into an I, an A. So this will, they will all color F vowels into different, well, this one stays the same, but this one will color it into an O or something like that. So, you know, if you have H3 plus E, this will become O, right? So that's, now the laryngeals themselves will disappear. So if in Proto-Indo-European you have he, you will have a in daughter languages, etc. So That's the one important thing about, one of the important things about Lorenzo's. The others is that if you have a vowel, if you have the reverse, if you have e plus eh, or e plus, you know, the other one, you will have laryngeal coloring, and when the laryngeals disappear, you will have compensatory lengthening. So this will be colored into ah, and then when the laryngeal disappears, this all will lengthen into a long ah. And the same thing is true. Oh, and everything else. So you have oh, and then this becomes oh. So right now this sounds a little arbitrary, but it will account for insane variation in Indo-European language families. So laryngeals are there. The thing is, no one is 100% sure what they were actually pronounced like. They were nearly certainly not actually laryngeal sounds. The term laryngeal at the time was sort of invoked. The idea was, hey, maybe if we reconstruct enough, we can unify Indo-European with Semitic languages, or with like Uralic languages or something. And of course, in Semitic languages, you have these kind of laryngeals, so the idea was maybe they're the same thing. And I think even in Arabic, you have some vowel coloring.
Yeah,
laryngeals.
Yeah, whenever you have the emphatic ones, into the laryngeal ones, they're always much lower.
So that was part of the intuition that played into the possibilities. And it was totally insane at the time. Very elegant, totally insane. But when the Anatolian language family was discovered in the 20th century, it was sort of a vindication because H2 actually survives in Hittite. It's actually still there. It's all in the right place, in the right places where it should be. And I think that H3 survives in Luwian or some other Anatolian languages, but so that just blew everything open. Like it used to be this kind of crazy way of counting theory, but when this was discovered, you know, everyone comes over to laryngeal theory, and it was like the biggest thing.
Nice.
Very
cool. Yeah. So
even though it survived in these languages, we don't know how exactly it sounded even in these languages.
Yeah. Well, in Hittite, H2 is probably just a glottal H, just like English. So that was the whole. I don't know if we're even sure about this in Luwian, but it doesn't give us any clue of what it might have sounded like before. Well, if you look at the consonant chart, so if you look at, you know, the fricatives, some people said, well, possibly fricatives. Maybe they go into the empty spaces with palatal plane and labial velar, because, I mean, keep in mind, H3, it has some kind of rounded quality to it because it's making O's. Maybe it's some kind of labiovelar fricative or something like that. Or, you know, the H1 is maybe a little palatal because it keeps you know, front of the mouth. But that's just sort of speculation. No one's super sure. Actually, importantly, in one way, they're very distinct from this. So I didn't say this before, but the line I draw in the chart, everything below the line can be syllabic. So you can have syllabic R's, L's, M's, N's, Y's, and W's. You can also have syllabic laryngeals. In fact, if you look at, actually, further up in the, and on the same page, you have the word for father, which is ter. So that is a syllabic laryngeal. And of course, it's H2. H2 becomes ah, so the end of the descendants of that, you'll have pater in Latin, etc., etc. So in that way, they're different from S because S is not cannot be syllabic, so far as we know, but laryngeals can. So.
Wait, why are we saying that? Why is someone else? The father doesn't have a vowel in it. That's a syllabic.
Because you get all the right answers if you say that.
I mean, if you said that it was a PH, then an E. That wouldn't give you the right answers.
No, because, you would
because
have...
Because it changes the vowel, right?
Well, okay, so the second laryngeal is, I'm trying to think why it would...
If I understand it right, you're drawing that you have this whatever vowel, and it changes to ah, and then this goes away.
Yeah.
What's the difference between just having this and turn into an A versus this turning into an A?
I'm not sure in this specific example.
What
is probably the case is that there is another reflex of this word where We'll talk about Ablau. Ablau will change the look of this, and we'll get something a little different.
Because the E should have changed or something.
Yeah, a lot of times you'll have stress shifts, and that'll happen. Any other questions so far? The generalities. So Indo-European languages are usually divided into two categories, and you've probably heard of them, Kentum and Satum.
Yeah.
So Kentum is the Latin word for language, and Satum is the Vestan word, at least the ancient form of it. So of course you have these three series of velars, as we talked about. So you have palatals, you have planes, and you have velars. So in a Kentum language, this would be like. Most Western languages, so like Latin, Greek, English, Albanian, you will have Kentum languages, and in those situations, palatal velars and regular velars merge. So you have this. And then Satum languages, these will usually be Eastern languages. You will have the palatal velars will remain distinct. And these two, the plain velars and the labial velars, so it used to be that the idea was so you have Indo-European, and the first split you have is Kentum and Satum. Like, so all of the Kentum languages are in a category, all of the Satum languages are in another category. It's not necessarily true that that's the case. And even the geographic distinction is sort of questionable. So Tocharian, which was the other famous Indo-European language family discovered really late. Tocharian is spoken in China, or was spoken in China, in Western China, in the Tarim Basin. Tocharian, even though it's one of the most Eastern languages, they are militantly Kentum. So they have all these. And Balto-Slavic languages are Satum languages. So it's not, perfect there. The only family that does not fit into this classification is Anatolian. So Anatolian, I think Hittite itself is a Kentum language, but other Anatolian languages, notably Luvian, actually has a distinction between all three of these. It's the only Indo-European language we know that does this. And there, this becomes like some kind of African.
Where is examples for those?
You can look at the examples on, I guess, page 3. So usually in Satim languages, of course, in Avestan you have Sa. In Persian, this will refer to Sanskrit, you'll have Cha or something like that. It'll just be some kind of. The reason I'm making it abstract here is because in every language family, something a little different. So usually what happens is that all of these will sort of become more like plain velars. So in Sanskrit, quas will become like ka, not vice versa. Same thing here, palatals will become like plain velars. And this is where in the palatal forms, this is where, at least in Sodom languages, this is where you have a lot of affrication. Things will become sibilants and stuff.
Sorry, you said they become plain velars. So that one's a plain velar.
So
these all actually become plain velars?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry.
Oh.
I wasn't thinking.
Oh, okay.
So the labial velars will just sort of get sucked up by the plain velars in Sodom languages, and in Kentum languages, the palatals get sucked up by. So you can see the reflexes here. So Sanskrit, palatal ka becomes sha, but normal ka and kwa both become k or cha. C is cha in Sanskrit. And that's a positional variant. I think it's before e or I, you get cha.
Why best in doing all these things? These are all just based on position?
Yeah, they're pretty much all positionally derived. I don't know that much about the best to tell you what exactly their positions are, but they are systematic, if they're like that. And I mean, look at the Latin ones are actually are really good. Look at the reflexes of gua. So you have fa, you have gu, you have ba, you have ba. You have all these different outcomes of the, you know, this one sound. Mm. And they're, again, they're positional variants, and they're totally phonetically distinct. So it's just a little, I mean, obviously they all either have a velar or a labial quality to them. But, you know, it's different. So,
the last page you've got here.
That's a poem.
I find it they're very entertaining to see just how similar Italic and Celtic are.
Yeah.
And how reasonable it is to support that they were the same branch.
Yeah. Well, when you really look at it, all of these language families are weirdly similar. I mean, you wouldn't really think that, you know, Anatolian is so closely related to Proto-Germanic, you know. But you sort of get that. Well, and again, this poem is constructed to use the words that basically all of them have. So, you know, they're supposed to look similar, but.
Which one are we supposed to?
Oh, yeah, so.
Understand.
So this
probably
is. Probably none of them. I mean,
yeah.
The Germanic one is no more accessible than anything else. So the top left is labeled Indo-Hittite. That just basically means Proto-Indo-European. They're just using the terminology, the idea that, you know, Hittite broke off a lot. So,
Oh, and then they separate into European and Indo-Iranian?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, those are just the sub-proto families. It's not necessarily one set goes one way.
I think it just goes by time. Because it's like 250 B or 2500 BC at the top.
Yeah.
And it goes all the way up more.
That's the Kentum Satum split, isn't it? The European and the Indo-Iranian.
Well, I just want to make sure. Yes, in fact it is, but I just want to be clear that the Kentum Satum split was not just one split. There seems to be the palatal sounds you'll have a merger of the three different groups some way, and it's not totally clear when it all happens, and it happens in a lot of languages. But there's no point where you can say, okay, the Kentum tribe went this way, and the Satum tribe went that way. That's sort of a good old Indo-European. So holvis hequosque. So ovis, that's Latin, ovis, that's you in English, the word for ship. Sheep, hequos, equestrian. You know. Que is,
sorry, what
did you say
about the first word?
So,
you
and
the
word
E-W-E, the other
E. That's sort of an old word for sheep.
Yeah, that
so,
one.
Hequos, like in Latin, I think, and then que is like, you know, the, like and, like, I'm trying to think of, is there a time in English that we use, like, senatus populesque romanus?
Yeah,
so,
yeah, I don't
yeah.
know if there's an attested variety of English that
uses
them. Yeah. Like all of them use, like,
word order the same for all of these? Should it be?
Word order is something that's not totally clear. But we should reconstruct. I think the general idea is that SOV was the standard order, but it's not. It's we're not sure. We can't really be sure about that. I'm trying to think if there's anything notable in this.
So, where else does this sheep word survive in other languages?
Is there a Persian word you're thinking of?
Not at all. No, the modern Persian word comes from cow.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
What is it?
Mustan.
So there's Latin always, and then I know a lot of other languages have similar sounds phonetically.
Oh, Okay, Latin is always.
Always
like double.
It's spelled with a V. It's pronounced in classical Latin. It's pronounced with a double. Always.
I know there are a lot of other connections to that word. I think. I don't know any examples, but I'm almost certain that in a lot of Indo-European languages, there's a word that roughly means wealth that is directly related to that.
Well,
sheep.
Well, in Latin, of course, you have, so pecus means cattle, and if you're rich, so pecunia means money, comes from the word for cattle. You know, if you're pecunious, is there an English word?
I don't think there's
any. I feel like
there should be. There should be.
Yeah. So, we might be able to go, actually, the thing is, to me, a lot of the poem actually makes sense, because, I don't know, I guess I'm a speaker of Proto-European.
A native speaker.
Yeah, frankly, if you've studied a classical language, like, just studying Latin, you can look at this and you can be like, oh yeah, that makes total sense, like, what that is. Like, the ending, we'll go into the morphology.
So Latin is, like, more, like, closer to Proto-Indo-European than
English, yes.
Well, no, than, like, Middle Persian?
I don't know about Middle Persian.
Middle
English.
Definitely. More than Old English, yes. But it's not
because the Latin that you study was spoken 2,000 years ago. Middle Persian and Old English were spoken 1,000 years ago.
Time isn't the best metric because so in Indo-European studies there are a bunch of jokes about all of us make fun of people who like Sanskrit a lot because there are a bunch of these occult beliefs about Sanskrit, like how it's like the first language and how it's like, you know, it's how humans think or something shit like that. So you'll always make fun of Sanskrit people. You'll also make fun of Lithuanians because the Lithuanian language is weirdly well preserved. Like, it has a lot of the Proto-Indo-European morphology. It hasn't changed that. I mean, there have been a lot of phonetic changes, but it looks sort of Indo-European. So there's this old myth that, like, oh, a Lithuanian farmer could talk to a speaker of classical Sanskrit and they would get along, and, you know, so. So there are some languages that are more preserved than others.
Tell us about this poem.
That's kind of strange, isn't it? Because Lithuanian is a Baltic language, right? That's one of the last families to distinctly form. Or to be attested, at least, I guess.
Yeah, it's one of the last attested families. I mean, it sort of brings into question what causes language change. And it might be that on the steppes, you might have had people speaking some kind of Indo-European dialect for a very long time. And it's only once they left them and had contact with other language groups and societies that the language really began to change a lot. So Baltic languages are relatively well conserved. Other languages, Albanian is notorious. People had no clue that Albanian was Indo-European until very recently. There's some languages that are just, they've changed so much that, if we didn't have information about Celtic languages before recently, like, it would be hard to tell that they were Indo-European, you know. But, did you say something?
Yes,
you
said let's talk about the poem.
Let's talk about the poem.
Let's go through it more.
Okay, so, Hovis Hecus Quae, so the sheep and the horses. So, Hovis Quesio Vulna Ne Est, the sheep to which there was no wool. Literally. So, ulne, that's where we get wool from. It's also where you get lana in Spanish and stuff like that, so it's more to one thing. Hequum specet, so specet, like spectacle.
Specio in Latin.
Yeah, yeah, so that's true. Yeah, so that's where Latin gets its word. And we won't talk about the morphology too much because, so hequums, that's accusative plural or whatever. So hoinom kurham wogom wigentum.
Sorry, so specet isn't related to horse?
The horse? No.
Is that horse?
Specet is sea.
Oh, that's
yeah.
One, sorry.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Hequums, that's the one for horse?
Yeah.
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 And is it related to horse?
No, no, it is not. I'm nearly certain that there's a reflex of it, of this word in Old English, but...
Is it related to the Latin word?
Yes, equus, like equestrian. No, that's not the old word, like
dog. I've heard the like scientific name for horse, equus cobellus. So.
Yeah, so that's a Latin.
Yeah, actually, I think I was talking to you about a horse in English. It's one of those words that probably came from the people who were living in Scandinavia before the German Germanic peoples got there.
Mm-hmm. So what's the Cabalist thing? Is that also...
How did Latin get the word?
Yeah,
oh, Cabalus. Originally, that was a Latin word that meant some kind of, like... shed horse, like not a, I'm trying to think of the word in English, maybe more like a pony or something like that. I don't know if it's traceable to the European, but yeah, Romance language, actually, teaching moment. One thing we got to make super clear. So a proto-language, like when you reconstruct a bunch of languages into a proto-language, the proto-language is still a theoretical concept. Like all of these are theoretical. So you can take... So we know as a fact that there was Vulgar Latin, and we know that somehow Spanish and French and whatever come from it. But you can actually do what you do with Indo-European languages to Spanish and French, and you can reconstruct a proto-language.
Yep.
So you can have what's called proto-Romance, which is similar but not the same as Vulgar Latin. So in proto-Romance, you have this word, cabalus. Actually, I think this is a tested section or something. Which you might not show up in Vulgar Latin texts because they might be saying equus. But this is just the important distinction between like actual real languages and proto-languages, which are theoretical.
Yeah.
But some of them are better indications of what how people actually spoke. So, if we can go on. So notice that every single word in line 4 ends with an M, just as a note. That's the accusative marker. So the first word is one, the second word is something like cart, or I think the word car is actually related to this. The third word is what, like heavy or, yeah, heavy it translates. And the last one is carrying. So it's like, in line 3, it says it sees the horses, one, in line 4, one carrying a heavy wagon or something like that. And they're all accusative marked.
Sure.
So line 4, oinum que, que, again, is and, one and a great load or something, a big load. And then another carrying a man, something like that. Oh, I guess, yeah, there is a translation. Yeah, one carrying a man quickly. So the sheep says to the horses, I never forget words in English. For some reason, horse is not like in my consciousness. I don't talk about horses much. So Kurt, that's a good Indo-European word. Heart. So cardiac arrest. The English word heart. Pains to me is my heart pains to me, something like that. To see all of these in line 9. To see all of these horses. Working, I guess, for a man. Oh, seeing a man driving horses. Okay, that's how I did. And so the horses respond. Oh, it's really not that bad. You actually have it worse, I think, if I remember it. So they say in line 10, "Listen, holy, good old vocatives." Yeah. So Kurt. Our hearts pain us when we see this. A man, the master, makes the wool of his sheep into a garment for himself. So the sheep has no, to which there was no wool. So, again, Indo-European doesn't really have a word for have, so you say stuff like, the book is and good old participles. This hearing, having heard this, or something like this, the sheep fled into the field. Or something like that. And well, Hegrom, that's a good word. Hegrom, you get the word acre. Also, when you get
agriculture,
through Latin and stuff like that. So yeah, that's
Acra in Greek, right?
Yeah.
We get
like,
no, agoraphobia.
I don't know if that's. I don't think that's really related.
No.
It might be
fear of big open spaces.
No, well, I think agora comes from somewhere else. It might not. You might be right. I'm not sure. So, the last thing is the battle inventory. So I guess anyone have comments before we touch on that? So, Indo-European has somewhere between, or pre-Indo-European has somewhere between 1 and 10 vowels. So that's actually, that's a lot of variation, so we should have.
Yeah.
So if you do the comparative method and you end up with Proto-Indo-European, you get 10 vowels. And they're the 10 vowels that every good 10 vowel language should have. I, U, O, and U in long and short variants. Just for illustrative purposes. So some kind of like distinction. So that's what you get when you do the comparative method. But as I said, you have these crazy things called laryngeals and stuff that sort of actually weed away on the morphophonemics behind it all. So a, long e, and long u, and some instances of the other vowels can be derived from losing a laryngeal and compensatory lengthening. So remember, there are a lot of situations where you might want to reconstruct something like long e. But a lot, pretty much all of these can also be reconstructed something like this with some kind of laryngeal. If you do this, it actually becomes unnecessary to reconstruct any of these. So this, and this, and I'm pretty sure all. You know, so you actually have a shorter, if you go into pre-Proto-Indo-European, you actually have a much smaller vowel inventory. E and U, these can actually be thought of as syllabified glides. So again, glides can be syllabified, you don't really need these. And importantly, you never have a cluster of I and young. Almost for IPG, geez. So you never have clusters like this reconstructed in your own like these. So that might be reason to think that really they're the same thing. Like E is just a syllabified young. And it's just don't really need those.
Do you ever see E, I before any other vowels? I mean,
you don't have diphthongs really. That's what
I mean, I'm saying is there's, we got Y, right? And Y is coming before vowels sometimes.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm just saying, could you think of it the other way, that actually this Y that you have on the consonant chart is actually a Y or demoted
okay.
E?
When we talk about roots, it'll make more sense because basically every Indo-European root ends up looking something like this, like C, R, V, R, C, where R is a resonant, that's the term for like nasal glide, laryngeal. If you assume it like this, if you assume that they're actually underlyingly resonance, it's a lot more elegant, way more elegant than saying, you know, because you have a simpler so got rid of those. So most all instances of A and O can be derived by laryngeal coloring. And I will, so basically you can nearly certainly get rid of A except for a couple of words. So I think the word for salt definitely has, I think it's something like sun. You sort of need it here, but it's so marginal that it's like, you know, there's one, it's like B, you know, there are just one or two instances you might not necessarily need it. So this is like a tentative, we don't necessarily need that. And a lot of O's are derived from laryngeal. differential coloring. And I didn't put it, but... And as for the rest of them, so as for E, O, and, well, really all of these, we'll talk about maybe next week. Indo-European has a system of ablaut, which can be reconstructed to be a variation between these four sounds and schwa, or and null, basically. And it seems that at some level these were morphophonemic variants of each other. And if you assume that, basically all you need in the language is a. Like every root is not, actually I shouldn't even put this, every root in the language is actually this. So it's consonant, resonant, a, resonant, consonant, something like that. So it's a very elegant system if this is all right. A lot of it, and again, if you go into an Indo-European journal and say, oh, pre-Proto-Indo-European only has one vowel, people will be like, okay, that's not really true, but it's so close to being true. So it's just, and people are sort of moving in that direction, and then, you know, that seems, like more and more cases can be weeded out by having a simpler system. So that's just a good thing. It's actually a very quick plot. Well, I'll read in English. Once there was a king, he was childless. The king wanted a son. He asked his priest, may a son be born unto me? The priest said to the king, pray to the god Wernos. The king approached the god Wernos and prayed to the god. Hear me, Father Wernos. The god Wernos came down from heaven. What do you want? I want a son. Let this be so. And the bright, said the bright god Wernos.
The bright young son.
And the king's lady bore son. So yeah, that's a very quick part.
That god.
Where knows that? I don't know if that's part of the Indo-European pantheon, which may or may not have existed. So there were a bunch of like interesting folkloric stories in Indo-European. Untrue, and many of them maybe are true.
Yes, like how aliens spoke Proto-Indo-European, and then
I saw that movie. So there are a lot of things associated with Indo-European origins. We mentioned honey, we mentioned wheels. It's very, Indo-Europeans originated about the same time and place as horse domestication, so that might have been why they spread so quickly. Potentially they developed chariots, so they're, I mean, you know, all of this is very circumstantial. You know, you hear people talking in the Bible about, you know, people from the north with chariots, so that's enough to go off of. When you have nothing, or lactose tolerance. Lactose tolerance does seem to have spread with Indo-European languages. People who speak Indo-European languages are much more lactose tolerant than, the people who are genetically Indo-European, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Speaking English doesn't just make you
lactose tolerant.
Yeah,
it does.
It's
all
learn
English, guys.
It's all learning English.
It's sort of on scan evidence because, I mean, in a way we can, because, you know, so Indian gods seem to mirror the Greek pantheon in some way, and the Latin pantheon, but a lot of them are sort of circumstantial, like we don't, I really just want to be cautious, so there are a bunch of things that people will say about the Greek based on one or two reconstructions that might be, I mean, just as an example, so there is a reconstructed word for guest in Indo-European. And, you know, people who talk about Indo-European cultural wars say stuff like, oh yeah, well clearly they have a word for guests, so you are very hospitable, you know, kind of, you know, nice, you know, these kind of things are circumstantial. A lot of the stuff, the actual religion is circumstantial.
But we did know that they had, like, deities that...
They were not atheists, probably.
Yeah,
they
were rolling around the plane and freaking
watching watching you the rest of us. Religion's so dumb, guys. No, they were not like that.
But, again, my memory is not doing well, but we can connect at least a handful of... God names etymologically, right?
Yeah.
At least in the West.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, we can put some individual names together and see that they match. What we can say on what the gods symbolized, what, you know, what they meant in the culture, things like that. I mean, there's
that's much harder.
Yeah. So
it's
rough. But yeah, so, and just in general, historical linguistics, I mean, Indo-European was the first big example of reconstructing a language family. I mean, since then, like, historical linguistics is really important for, if you want to trace how Bantu people moved in Africa, look at their languages, and the phonetic changes in their languages will tell you how they moved, basically. Same thing with Polynesia and stuff like that. It's actually less true of Indo-European, because sort of contact between these two different groups at all times. So does anyone have anything they want to specifically? So I think definitely we should talk about Avalon laryngeals sometime next week. I don't know how long it will take.
I was also hoping we move to some of these languages.
That's what I was thinking. After that, I think we should go through these languages. I think we should start with Anatolian, even though that's probably the language that all of us are least interested in. It's probably the most important family for Indo-European. And then you're interested in Persian, so Iranian.
I'm also interested in the Greek, the Indo-Aryan.
Well, we will get to all the cool ones. We might leave Albanian out. But yeah.
Oh, well.
So I didn't know. I actually looked up for this correspondence chart. I looked up all the words in Persian too. I didn't know. So like, what was it?
Oh, is that why you were?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you a couple of words. There were some weird ones I didn't know. So, sad is related to horn.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I wrote a couple of them down. The coolest phonetic change. Actually, it's not the coolest. But so GW, so wa. It ends up in a bunch of weird things in different languages. So Sanskrit jiva, Greek bios, Latin vivus. So in Greek, it becomes B in certain circumstances. This blew my fucking... I don't take notes in class, ever, but when I was in Indo-European and my teacher noted this, I just shat my pants. I actually had to write this down. So you never think this, okay? It's weird enough that all of these reflexes are so different in different languages, but in Greek alone, you actually have different... Depending on the location of what... A root can end up in different forms. So you have bios, so that means life. So like biology. Also, I'm trying to so let's say the European. Okay, so in Greek you have bios, then you have zoe. Where we get zoo from in English. And then you have hygiene. So the G here, the Z here, and the B here actually all come from the exact same Indo-European root that means life. Even in one language, which, depending on their location, they show up as totally different sounds.
Do you know what happens to this word in Indo-Iranian? Because the first word for live is, like, the root is Z.
You
can look it up. I'm not sure. Duck, duck, go, save me. Oh, wait, I wrote this down. So, zisten, that's live or something like that?
Yeah.
So that is related, as is zendegi.
Yeah, yeah. These are all, like, lots of sentences, so the root is just z.
Yeah. So, I'm trying to... I don't know exactly what... that would make sense. So the laryngeal... Okay, so quick was the was ending there. That's like nominative singular. This is like an adjective in Indo-European. The stem would be quick, and then laryngeal drops off, and then I guess in Indo-Iranian it's a Z, so that would make sense. And then... Also, I didn't know this. Furnus in Latin, also related to forma, related to warm. Things I didn't know.
Gap.
Also related to thermometer.
Warm.
I didn't cross any of the Indo-European. Okay, so if you want to know the Indo-European, first one is father, obviously.
Yeah.
Second one is strength. Third one is bear. Fourth one is like thin or breakable.
Yeah, there's the English column.
Oh, well, the English ones aren't always the same. So, next one's tooth, same as English. The next one that gives us do is more like set up or place or something like that in Indo-European. That's what it is in Sanskrit. What is care? I want to say that is horn, but I'm not entirely sure. Then genhu, that's baguette. It's not kin. Then gel is shine, gives us yellow. And it's interesting, so helvus is sort of like yellow. Chloros in Greek is more like yellow green, something like that. Krech, that's a good one. That's like, that means like blood and guts, or like carnage. Carnage, that's the one. That gives us raw. Kosti is guest. Quell is real. Guihuos. Yeah, so also, guihuos means alive. In English, it becomes quick. I never thought it. And then, it's the last one, of course. So. The voiced aspirates are really voiceless, or at least unspecified for voice, or something like that. And
they're aspirated, but we don't know.
Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, in some definitions, if you're talking about just VOT, voiced aspirated is a contradiction.
Yeah.
So, like, you have to have something else going on to actually produce those sounds in the voice.
Do you know anything about stress in your?
Yes. I don't know if we know that. I think it's, I mean, we know what takes stress in Indo-European roots, basically. And stress also, I erased it, stress also has an interface with ablaut, in that if you stress something before, you'll get a different, so it changes the vowel quality.
We also like know how verbs are conjugated and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they're reconstructed.
I mean, yeah.
But, yeah, we have a very good idea about the verb system and the noun system. And, you know, we can go over that, too. I mean, that's one of the reasons, I mean, phonological similarities are nice, but morphological similarities are the kinds that, like, really, oh, this is, like, for real, you know? And of course, has anyone studied like a classical language here?
Classical Latin.
So, I mean, if you look at when you see the endings, you will recognize them originally. Because they do sort of look like, you know, what you have in the different languages.
Like, what are the endings?
Well, as I said, so in is an ending, so an Indo-European classical language. So F is, so this is nominative, accusative, singular, plural. Again, nominative, so accusative is M, and then you'll have like usually like NS or MS for plural, and then you'll have different things here, usually like OS or something like that. And that's pretty systematic. The thing, if you actually reconstruct Indo-European phonology, you will notice that it's actually a lot more simple than morphology. It's a lot more simple than morphology in like Greek or Latin or whatever. So in Greek you have all this irregularity, you have a bajillion different types of ending, like you'll have different conjugations that take different verb endings or whatever. But basically because all of that, if Indo-European had that kind of complexity, it's been lost. So what we have is really just a couple tables of morphemes that work very well for all.
So, like, many of these languages develop more complex morphology after splitting.
It's sort of debated. So most, so there are 8 cases, for example, that we're pretty sure that all Indo-European languages have. So, like, there's nominative, accusative, dative, genitive, ablative. It's a very nice case. It's a shame Latin isn't. So these 8 can be reconstructed very easily in Indo-European. There are other ones that might have arisen later. So in Hittite, there's an ablative case, so ablative means moving away. So like if I say Mosen and I put an ablative ending on you, that means I'm moving away from you. So I'm going Mosen ablative. I'm moving away. Ablative would be the reverse. I'm coming towards you. So you have those in the Luwian. You have a couple other cases, but they all seem to be like the result of postpositions and stuff. But in what I meant is like in Latin. So nominative singulars. So some end in us, some end in a, some end in s, some end in, you know, they all have different endings. But in Indo-European, you just have one for each little block. Very nice.
So, well, yeah, you could say that the declensions are Latin's own contribution to.
Yeah, in a way, but I mean, one of the things is keep in mind what internal reconstruction was doing. So, you take the irregularity in a language and you sort of get rid of it by positing more elegant structures that gave birth to them all. So, these endings in Latin, if you reconstruct them, they could be reduced to just one ending in Proto-Indo-European. And they interact differently in words with different stress patterns, but they can be reduced to this one form. Or really two. So you also have like the, you know, feminine ending or whatever, but that's different. So,
well, that's, I think, the only way language could possibly become more complex, right?
Yeah.
Split something that you.
Yeah. So Indo-European, Proto-Indo-European grammar is a lot easier to learn than Sanskrit grammar or something like that. But one of the reasons, mind you, is that Indo-European could have been this incredibly complex language, But all of the irregularity has been lost. Like, we don't know anything about it. So it could be that they did have a gajillion different ways to indicate nominative singular. It's just this one survived. Or it's the one that the daughter finally sees. So,
I wish these people wrote down what they were saying.
Yeah. So yeah, the poems are, I forget, it probably says where they were written. Yeah, I got all these off dongdu.com, so.
Or dongdu.org.
So this is the Indo-European word for language, so the word language actually comes from it. Also, tongue comes from it. So, like in Latin, so you have a transformation from D to L, and that's where you get. So I guess I showed some of you guys this site. It has like an Indo-European lexicon and dictionary grammar, stuff like that, which is pretty cool. So I don't think the guys who run it are actually linguists, but they're pretty confident. So.
What do people do in historical investigations in
European?
What's the type of research?
Well, they usually end up doing comparative reconstruction or internal reconstruction. Most of the debates are over how to reconstruct individual terms, you know, what's a morpheme, what's not, just sort of what should be the theoretical reconstructed language, what's the relationship between, you know, the different language families, stuff like that. It's part of linguistics that sort of requires a very wide range of knowledge, I guess. Like, you can't be just good at phonology or morphology, or you also have to be good at history and all these things, so.
Actually, a guy just, maybe 2 years ago now, finished his dissertation on WH movement in Hittite. Because it doesn't move. Or it's usually in season.
That was this whole dissertation.
It doesn't.
What? Why?
Chapter 2. Why it doesn't?
Because it doesn't.
Because chapter 3.
It doesn't.
Give me a job.
No features. No features.
Jobs.
So I guess next week we can talk about. We should go over Apple and I'll show you guys the actual data. It's a little hard to wrap your mind around, but it's like, you know, again, one of the consummate achievements of linguistics generally. And we can go through talking about individual things. We should talk about the noun and verb system. That's what we should talk about briefly. But after that, I think we should do that thing, you know, just going through individual language families, whatever interests us. Probably starting with Hittite, but after that, anything's good. So.
I don't like dealing with text.
Hittite is. Well, it's Hittite. So.
It doesn't have any direct or indirect descent from Sumerian.
Hittite, so the only two language families in Indo-European that we know are dead are Anatolian and Tocharian, which suck because they're the two most interesting. They're the two oldest, probably, as well. Tocharian isn't attested to lately, but it's clear it's like the second author of the
Boy.
So, oh boy.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what would have happened to Anatolia or run over by Roman?
It's actually hard to. So Anatolian languages. There's Hittite and Luthian. Those are the ones most important. Luthian was probably actually the language of the Trojans, just in case you didn't know. But